So, John Lamorne, hands up anybody who'd heard of him before you saw the notice for this meeting. That's about it, isn't it? Now, I'm going to claim that he is one of the greatest men of Wharfedale. He was a young chap from Launde, and I don't know if you know it, it's up on the far side of the valley from Bolton, only about 3 miles up. He was made prior at the age, roughly, we don't know when he was born, because you don't know anything like this in the Middle Ages normally. And we don't know quite when he died either. But anyway, he was made prior in about 1285 or 6. And he went on, and the next prior we know started in 1330. So as you see, he put in something like 45 years. So he must have been pretty young when he took over the Bolton Priory. And it was in a mess. It had been pretty well ruined by a succession of very bad priors who spent a lot of their time hunting and instead of keeping the services and doing the looking after the estate. And as I'll be able to tell you, in the course of the first 15 years there, by 1300, he'd made Bolton Priory into one of the great estates of our neighbourhood. Don't think of it like, you know, a Cistercian village. I grew up in a Cistercian village in Northumberland, and every place in the village was called after, you know, it was Applegarth, or Swinstey, Swine, you know, etc. Carver, Abbey Cowper, etc. But it wasn't like that with Bolton. They were given, as a priory, plots of land all over the place, from Malham in the north, west, right down to Harewood, down the wharf. So you can see the scatter of land that they had to manage. And very varied land, good for quite different sort of products, as it were. And he had to learn, with the help of a very good brother John, who was, I'm pleased to say, he was a lay brother who was allowed to work in the fields and go out and probably lived a lot of his time in Malham, actually, based in Malham, I should think, because there was one of the first of their big sheep runs. Not perhaps equaling Fountains, but then, you know, Fountains would probably have, 10,000 sheep, I guess, something like that. They got up to over 3,000. And if you have a farm, 3,000 feet sheep takes a lot of looking after. That's the man we're talking about today. A local lad, and a small priory. You've got to think of it not as, you know, 100 people, but something like 14 to 16 canons, as they were called, the brothers. And they didn't really have to keep to the steady services that the Cistercians did, you know, seven times a day and all that. They were allowed a good deal of liberty in the way that they behaved. And I must say, Prior John put it to very good use, as you'll be hearing. Of course, it's... We have to try and break up his life, so I put it into five sets. Two pilgrimages to Rome, terribly important in those days, as I tried to explain. Setting up the sheep herds and the coats and trading in wool. Trading in wool who with? With the merchants from Florence. From Florence. Yeah. So, you know, this was the big time in terms of wool trading. Administering the estate. If you've got any knowledge of farming, let me tell you that ploughing out at Bolton on the home farm, guess how many acres they ploughed? 800 acres every year ploughed, mainly for oats. Yeah. We'll explain why. And if you know anything about the weather around here, which was a more reliable crowd. Then a little bit about the way of life in the priory, and finally this terrible catastrophe which affected most of Northwest Europe and was particularly savage for us in Yorkshire, in the Ridings, because as well as first of all a sheep moraine, as they called it, sheep some sort of infestation, we don't know what, which decimated the sheep flocks, and then they got they had 2 years of incessant rain during harvest time, which affected the whole of Northwest Europe. Then they had deadly frosts. The Baltic was twice frozen over in the Baltic Sea was twice frozen over in the 1300s. And finally, just to crown it all, to pay us back for the fact we've been invading Scotland under Edward I time after time in the 1300s, the Scots came down and had a very good time raiding off all the oxen they could get hold of, getting hold of the grain from the barns, carrying it off up the wharf, across, of course, therefore, especially among Bolton barns, and then up back through the Lune Gorge, if you know that way, back home into Scotland. They came down across the east coast. So that was the terrible catastrophe. I think I'm going to have about 3 minutes on each of those by the look of it, so it's rather fast going. So we're starting off with the pilgrimages. Now, I don't think we can appreciate what a pilgrimage is like. Even if there's somebody here who's been to Mecca on the Hajj, you still can't think what a medieval pilgrimage was like. I mean, if John de Lond came into that room now, most of us would be kneeling down and asking for his prayers, because he had twice been to Rome and had been to the, had seen the skulls of St. Peter and St. Paul, and had been able to see the cloth that had been used to wipe Jesus' brow when he was crucified. Do you see what I mean? You were part of a magic circle. And you had power. You had a kind of power to do things which we peasants, because I'm counting all of us as peasants, which we peasants would give anything to be in touch with. If only he could be on our side. If only his prayers could be helping us. So, what were we afraid of? Well, it's not very difficult to envisage. I don't know if you can see that at the back. Oh, perhaps we can have some lights off at the back. That might help. The demons, the spirits that are surrounding us, that are outside now, that will lift the thatch off our roof, that will strike down our cattle, that will come and plague our children, that will do everything malevolent against us. And that's the whole of the universe of our lives is infested with these evil creatures. And have a look at it. You can see. It's obviously ready to bite and chew you up, one or two adults, isn't it? So you're really living part of your life in terror of these demons, because of course everything that goes wrong you put it down to them. You see what I mean? We've got these rational explanations. In the Middle Ages, many people, the peasants particularly, thought, no, it's the demons that come today and they've hit me, you know. And that's it. So you can imagine that going to church wasn't just a matter of saying a prayer or two. It was looking for some kind of divine help. And here's one of the pictures from exactly the same time as John de Lond of the kind of inspiration, I think. Can you see at the back? the kind of inspiration they were looking for. That kind of benign, pitying Lord that would help them. And I just want to quickly show the contrast with the kings and bishops. At the bottom of this picture there's a king and a bishop. I think it's actually it's from the North Riding, I'm pleased to say. But you can see they don't look very reassuring. The king is pretty a toughie, and the bishop looks even more so. And I'm not quite sure why we can't get that angel as well. But there's an angel, and anybody who knows the Renaissance sculptures might be surprised to know that that sculpture, which I think comes from Bedleyminster, is only about 1330, you know, about the same time as John the Lawn. And they're doing these beautiful figurative sculptures in our great churches, like Bedleyminster. So you were looking for some form of help and assurance. And when John de Lorme set off from Bolton, I guess that one or two people from Malham would be down there, and there'd be a whole throng of people outside the priory, and they'd be kneeling down and calling for his blessing as he set off, because he'd already been once in 87, I think it was, 1287, to Rome, and now here he was setting off in 1300. And 1300, Pope Boniface had declared a jubilee year, and anybody who went to Rome and performed with penance at the five stations, the rite rituals, would be given plenary forgiveness for all their sins. So it was a big package, wasn't it? And thousands came from all over Europe, including, as Pope Boniface said, thousands will come from peasants to lords, and John was one of them. And we can actually piece together his journey, if you wanted to ask questions about that. We know roughly the sort of route that the people took. We even know the cost of the ferry from Dover to Calais, if you had a horse. And they managed about 25 miles a day on that journey, which is quite a tough journey when you think of it in the middle of it. They managed about 25 miles a day. So there's the kind of man they were looking for. And as a result of that, perhaps, when he came back in 1301, actually it was middle of 1300, when he came back, his order, the Augustinian order, obviously looked up to him, and in about 1305 they made him the visitor for all the northern Augustinian houses. And there's a lot of them around here. I mean, Nostell Priory and places like, you've heard of all these priories. And the visitor, as it were, was intended to be the person who could combine firmness with benevolence. In other words, are you doing the right things? And if not, why not? And this is what you should be doing. But equally, well done, I'm very pleased to see all the things that you're doing, etc. And so he could give guidance and offer advice right over the whole of the north in those more than a dozen priories of the northern Augustinian order. A tremendous responsibility. Okay, so that's very briefly something about the that side of his life. Now I want to move over to what's equally important, and of course is very well attested in the accounts which he left behind him, and they're the best book of accounts we have for that period of the 1250 to 1350. It's this book here. You'll see it's about 500 pages, and it's a massive documentation of what it was like to run a priory with about 40 different patches of land from Malham, as I say, to Hereford. Now, how's that coming up? Well, yeah, sorry about that, but I thought I would just try it the other way around. Well, anyway, on this picture, we have at the top left a sheepfold. It's, of course, an artist's impression. You can't expect medieval artists to do that very well. And down below here, we have another example of a sheepfold, and I don't know if you can see, but there's actually snow on this extended roof that they have. Now, that's particularly important for you in Malham, because we do know that John de Lord was responsible. I think he started off in 1299. They sent up to Malham 1,000 flat boards. Now, that's all we know, that they're flat boards. And we know that there was a chap called Henry Le Slater who was partly responsible for what happened to them. And then we know that the next year they got what they call Moreno, which I imagine were the kind of crook beams that you made your main standing platforms for the sheepcote with. And then the next year they got another 1,000 flat boards up. So it must have been a pretty impressive job. I think we can say that much at least. And the reason why he needed it, if I can just check the figures in my notes, is that he'd actually put up the number of sheep. Yes, it was 1,200 sheep total for all the holdings, and I should think probably two-thirds of them up at Malham, because this is limestone ground, good for sheep, you know. You don't get foot rot so easily and things like that. Yeah. And 1,200 in 1296, and 14 years later, 3,500. Now, just think of that, because I mean, you'd be astonished if you had anything to do with farming because of the way you're nodding. I mean, it's astonishing. Do you know, they didn't get one lamb per yow in those days. It was less than one yow per lamb, one lamb per yow. So you got a very poor return, as it were, in your flock. But the flock did, it's quite different from our flocks. You had the ewes, or I'm sorry, Cumberland yow still sticks with that. The yows. You had the this year's lambs, the hogs. But you also had an even bigger number of what were called in the manuscript Multones, which are gelded males. And the gelded males were the ones that you got the really big fleece from. So they were really kept for their fleece. Of course, from, as you might tell from the word Multones, they became muttons later on in their lives, but that was what they were there for. So it was a very interesting kind of flock that you had. They got 3,500. I can't believe they'd have less than 2,500 up on the fell here in the summertime. I mean, there weren't good pastures elsewhere. There were two other sheepcotes, it's true. But I can't believe they'd had less than about 2,500. Well, of course, that meant you had six or eight shepherds with them to stay up with them in what were called lodges in the Latin. And I think you'd have to say they were like scales or sheds. I don't know about your dry stone walling, but my late wife's great uncle was famous for putting up a sheep shed in the corner of a field in one day if you gave him the stones. You know, that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of job they lived in for the summer. And I assume, I have no evidence on this, I assume they were brought down in the winter. I can't believe you'd leave sheep up on a high fell like that. I mean, that would be all against Cumbrian practice anyway. My brother-in-law had a cousin farming up high up on Skidder, if you know that mountain. And so their sheep came down to my brother-in-law's farm north of Bass Lake, 500 or so, and would come down in the autumn. So I think that they'd have to come down into land around here. And we'll see that there was a fair amount of land, because there's a second use of the land around here at the time. Okay, so I'm sorry about the pictures having come out so badly. They look nice on there, but they don't move. Anyway, we'll have to have another go. So, sheep. And what did they do? Well, we know for a fact that the sheep runs that Fountains had over to the west side of Malvern were taken down to Kinsey, and my guess, and shorn there, and then carted, the wool was carted up to Fountains. My guess is, and it's only a guess, that the Bolton sheep would be taken down to somewhere like Freshfield, you know, down conveniently on the wharf, and then carted down, wool would be carted down. And then they'd be baled, put onto pack horses, and they'd either be taken down to the Ouse and put on a boat there, or the pack horse would have to go all the way down, let's think, I have to think of it this way for you, all the way down into Lincolnshire to Boston. St. Botolph's Fair, which was the great fair that the Florentine merchants used to come up and buy the wool from this fine wool from the English monastic houses there, and buy it, obviously, you know, in real bulk, and then their galleys would take it back down. Those Florentine merchants, whose names are very well known in economic history, the Peruzzi and so on, the Black Circle, the different members of the group, the Bardi, and they're all famous in Florence because they were effectively the bankers of Europe. They didn't necessarily pay you money for your wool. Instead, they gave you spices. I've got a list somewhere of the spices. I think you ought to enjoy this. Let's see. Oh dear. No, it's no good. I'll get it later. Anyway, all the spices that you would expect to get, nutmeg, cumin, you name it, all of those spices were available at St. Botolph's Fair, and they would trade with you for those. And they also brought up, or at least you were traded through them, with wine from Gascony, which of course was an English possession at the time. And so there you were. You got your wine, you got your spices, you could take those back home, and the prior's brother, who was also a canon, their mother, Eva de Lorne, in fact, was one of the great benefactresses of the priory, and we know that Henry, the younger brother, was sent to Oxford for a couple of years, and he would go down, among others, to get make the exchange. You may notice wine and wonder, well, the answer is, they said, well, we need to have wine for when we entertain the important visitors. It's a story I've heard Oxford colleges in the same vein. That's why you have to have wine, to entertain the visitors, of course. Yes, well, there's only one drawback, that there's a note one year, somewhere in the 1300s, that a whole barrel, a ton of wine, disappeared at Tadcaster, and it's registered, and it's quite a testy remark about it, but there's no explanation at all of how that could happen. So,
fellows like the wagons in them days.
Yes. Anyway, so that's the what happens to the wool, and also I ought to say that in a register which doesn't survive, some of the money from the wall would be put aside every year to make the new stone fabric of the abbey, of the priory, because the priory, even in 1300, the priory still had a wooden roof over parts of it. You mustn't think of it as, you know, all being made in one go. No, not a bit. Okay. Right, managing the medieval estate, it's a tremendous job, because of all the ploughing. Now, why do all that ploughing? Well, the answer is you have to feed people.
Yeah.
You see, there are about, let's say, 15 or 16 canons, and then there are some pensioners who either live with you or who get their what's called corrivees from you. And of course, when you get these fellows up from Malham doing work for you in the fields, you have to give them a ration. You give them what's called a livery, and it'll be a bit of gruel or an oat cake and maybe half a pint of ale, oaten ale. But you need a tremendous amount. Why? Well, I was staggered when I read this for the first time about 15 years ago. What return on a ship of oats did you get? For every grain, at this point in Europe, for every grain of oats, you expected 3 grains. Now just think of it, because you've got to put one back the next year, don't you? So you're only making 2 grains. And of course, it's better if you sow wheat. For every grain of wheat you sow, you might get 5, you might get 6, if the weather's good.
If you can get it right.
But you know that our valleys, the wall, and they are not exactly perfect for growing wheat in, are they? No, that's true now, and it was just as bad before. So they got as much wheat sown as they possibly could, for reasons which we'll come to in a moment, that they had hundreds of acres of oats sown for every tens of acres of wheat. And that's why the ploughmen were kept working. Of course, they didn't have modern methods of manuring either, so you got a lot of cross ploughing and harrowing and all the rest to try to work the land. This ox team there, we only see half of them. I'm sorry, they're cut off because of the way the picture was made. But you see, there's quite a sophisticated plough there, actually, when you look at it. There's a share, isn't there? And you see the mouldboard. Here's the sharp cutting edge. And then you've got the mouldboard that turns the... And then, I forgot what that bit is called, but anyway, that takes the handle for the ploughman. They had to employ, I'm speaking from memory now, I think 10 or 12 ploughmen for the year at Bolton to get that 800 acres ploughed and re-ploughed and tilled. And they lived in a special place called the Hind House. Now, I don't know if the word hind still survives among you, but...
Did not long ago.
Right. My Grandad Dixon was a hind son from Northumberland. You know, they were still called hinds. And they were. I mean, they were working labourers on the big Northumbrian farms near the Tweed. So hinds lived collectively in this hind house. You may think, well, it's not much of a life, but the answer is, you've got a secure job, you know, you're there, and you're fed every day of the year, and you can't be sure of that if you've only got your small holding in Malham, your little peasant holding. You can't be certain of that. I did get the figures for Malham to see, we'll come to that when we have the catastrophe. Okay, so that's a little bit about managing the estate. hints of a way of life. Let's see if the pictures will come out. Well, the first thing is that you have to realise, you see the cooking over the flames at the top, with the somebody's actually turning the spit with the meat on up here, and the other fellow, I think he's just putting more fuel in, and then there's a table where they're chopping up the different steaks and limbs and preparing it. And the answer is, you obviously had to have people in the kitchen. And in fact, there was a head cook and there was an assistant cook. And also, by the way, there was a head brewer and an assistant brewer. And so it went on. So for the, let's say, 20 canons maximum, there'd be something like 40 servants working around the house and in the court, as it was called, for them. And a lot of lads, garçons is the kind of French style word for them, who were obviously just tucked away in corners and begging for their food and doing what work they could get, hangers-on, as it were, of the priory. So you had all of those feeding, and if you were... Yes, here we are. And then they have to serve it. So here we get the high table. And of course it's exactly the same in an Oxford college today. The high table with the dignitaries there, actually I take it that the commons would have to go right round the high table. But this method, can you see somebody coming there, a page or one of the garçons, coming to serve them from this open end of the board, which by the way is on trestles, you notice, you have these broad things. And here they are coming through from the kitchens, bringing the food, and if you could look at this in detail, these trenchers, they're kind of cups of bread that you put some of the fancy dainties in, or stews in, and then you eat the food. And by the way, the only implements on evidence are a knife or two. You don't use forks. That's not part of their method. So there they are, the high table, with no doubt the prior and the assistant prior, the sub-prior, and the great officers of the priory. And then down in this way, facing forward and aft that way, would be perhaps a table or two for the higher officers, like the cook, when he finished his work to eat at. They did pretty well. In fact, I did a little bit of working out, dividing out the actual food that went to them. The first thing is that the canons, being an upper rank, couldn't eat oats. They had to have wheaten bread. So the wheaten bread was baked for them twice a week. Now, that, of course, there was a baker and an assistant baker, as there had to be. And, here's my list of spices. And spicing this food, there would be peppers, ginger, nutmeg, cumin, columbine, mace, almonds, dill, saffron, licorice, cloves, peony, which was an Augustinian speciality, as well as sugar, figs, and rice. So it wasn't too bad a life at the high table there, you see what I mean. And when I averaged it out, oh dear, I'm cutting this talk, you see, that's why. Well, when I averaged out the meat, it was something like one ox, one sheep, two pigs, four fattened poultry capons, etc., per week for the 20. So, you know, you think about it, it's quite a hefty portion. But I imagine there were big leftovers, and of course some of that, even if you were lucky, would go to the poor. That was the notion. Yes. Okay.
Now, have we time? Yes, I have. 5 minutes now on the deluge.
Are they men or the women on there?
There's the women on there.
No, those are all men. That's their government. No, you can't be allowed to have women working in the courtyard. I'll tell you what the women did, if you go back to that. They went up onto the moor and they milked the sheep. And they carried up milk for the lambs from cows. They carried that up. So they were important in milking the sheep and in making cheese, where they helped to make the cheese from the sheep. So they had a very important job, for which I think they never averaged better than a penny a day, which was about the lowest possible wage you could get. No, I'm afraid there aren't any there. Anyway, so despite all the prayers and so on, these dark forces struck back, and you had the warning signs in the Baltic, then the English troops in 1314 were routed at Bannockburn, do you remember? Mm-hmm. And then the Scots started invading, and then you had the terrible harvests. So instead of getting 3 grains for one in oats, you were just getting the one. Mm. So what did that mean? It meant starvation. Mm-hmm. There was starvation throughout the whole of the north, and there are terrible comments in one of the chronicles about coming down the Great North Road and seeing starving people lying by the side of the road, still begging if they were alive, you know, but nothing could be done because there was just no food. Mm. And that was the condition of life in the Middle Ages, that things went badly. And then, of course, they'd also lost the lambs. They, from well over 1,700 yards, yards and lambs, they fell down to 370. I mean, colossal losses. Mm-hmm. And only 117 hogs made it through to the next spring. So it was a terrible period for everybody, including, of course, for John de Lorne, who'd somehow got to try and deal with it. I just thought you'd be interested to know how he dealt with it in terms of now. Mm. On the whole, Malham seems to have escaped. I think you were safe because you were out of the way for the Scots, you know. Yeah. It wasn't easy for the Scots to come up this valley. They could easily be trapped. So they didn't. Mm. So what happens is, when you look at the record, in 1320-21, after all these devastations, the Malham rental is the same as for before the deluge. It's 100 shillings and tuppence. And the plough team of 8 oxen are still there. Mm-hmm. So they survived. 8 oxen is the standard big plough team. You couldn't work with less. And then the harvest. Well, the scale of the crop doesn't sound so wonderful. Remember, 9 quarters of wheat. It's just short of enough for one person for a year. 9 quarters of barley and 67 quarters of oats. But some of that may have stayed in Malham because of being given to workers when they fulfilled various manorial services. However, as you see, you know, they were ploughing out with their robots and getting going on that. And there must have been a tremendous effort in terms of the herds, because of the Priory's total flock that year, which was down to 1,508. Terribly low, you remember, it was 3,500. Yeah. 1,508. Let's say about half were at Mull, okay? And of those, the following year, the herds must have done a magnificent job, because out of 583 yows, they got 538 lambs, which is very, very much better than the medieval average in our
average.
So there we were. And I thought you might like to know that as a result of that, the abbot was able to ask a number of people to pay their, what was called their recognition fines. I won't go into that. But when you were carrying over property, you had to pay money to your lord. And here they are, they're named in the compotus: William Delbank, I don't know if he's present today, Will de Aula of the Hall, Rob de Hellerfield, John Le Lamherd, Richard Le Hine, Richard Le Day, that's the dairy, Will de Meckelhaag and of Big Hedge, and Rob Kay. So all of those were able to pay up. So Malin has come through. I just want to spend just one moment on what happened to the prior. The prior, of course, with Scots coming pretty well every year in raiding parties around 1320, 1321, 1322, he was the ideal target, because it's not killing him, it's the ransom. A prior, wow, you know, that's what you can get a big ransom for. So of course his job was to keep out of their hands. So what he did, he went down to the farthest east he could, Rhyther, which is a little village right down where the Wharfe begins to join the Ouse. And it's of course the nearest place to York, which was safe refuge. That remained safe from the Scots raiding. He went there, and we've got all the precautions he took, because the first thing they did was to dig a deep ditch right round the manor house, cost 37 and tenpence. Then the next one was 52 roods of ditch, newly dug, cost £22. That must have been a big ditch, you know. And then the year after that, they actually repaired the ditch and put an earthen wall round the mansion, Muro Terre, and then finally they put a little fortification on the bridge across the ditch as well. That cost another 30 or 40 shillings. You may think that's nothing. They paid as an annual stipend to their head cook 5 shillings. So, you know, that, you have to think in those terms. Anyway, the prior was safe. He was in his 60s, and he still took on the whole organisation of this estate, even though the king had allowed some of the canons to go off to take shelter in better off Augustinian houses. And he still kept the accounts going till the last year, which is actually, I think, 1325. And as I say, I think you can count him as a great man. So if there are any questions about all the things I missed out, please let me know.
I was just looking at your food. You said it was hollowed out, the food.
Yes.
Was that the start of the Yorkshire puddings?
Yeah, good idea.
Filled the Yorkshire
puddings. It's
pudding.
Just like the Yorkshire pudding, isn't it? Yes.
And you ate your plate.
Oh, you ate your plate, of course, so yes.
Where did women come into all this?
Yes, I did have a few slides of women, so that you would think, well, first of all, obviously, they weren't very well paid for their services. That's one of their uses. Can you see the big spinning wheel on there? So they did the spinning of yarn, and here is one holding up the mirror to her lady's coiffure while she's being looked after.
So that's one thing they did. And of course the other thing which they did, if they belonged to the nobility, was to show off the wonderful colours, and I'm awfully sorry, this hasn't good for you. It's a lot better here. What you see it like that.
Oh, yeah.
This is the red, the wonderful colours of these, and that's done by Flemish weavers. They had the special dyes and special ways of making those wonderfully ornamented and coloured garments. That's actually a countess. So, the women had it hard.
Did you mean at the priory, though?
Well, at the priory, the Hindens, I mean, you said that all the Hindens lived in a building. Where, I mean, presumably they have families.
That's the question in which the compotus doesn't answer. And I think the answer may be that they came from local hamlets. So, I mean, I've had nephews when Cumberland was badly hit for work, who had to go up to Scotland and work all the week and then come back home at the weekend.
Okay. Just a comment about the wintering of the sheep. In the 1500s...
Speak up for everybody.
Sorry, in the 1500s, just before the dissolution, certainly from fountains, the sheep, like they are today, were going down to the Forest of Bourne to asylum places. And from Arncliffe Parish, certainly when I came across Fall, I think about 1550, again they were sending their sheep down to the Forest of Bourne. So it's going like it was going on then as it does today.
Did you say Bargain?
No,
Bolland.
Down in Lancashire.
Yes. Yes, so there might have been...
So I think it probably
was
going on forever.
That's fountains, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the Arncliffe wasn't... I mean,
the difference between the Cistercians and the priories is one of scale. I mean, it was nothing for a Cistercian abbey to have 100 monks. So you see, it's at least five times the size. Mm. So they would have agreements with Cistercian abbeys further south and do it that way. I know that Furness sent sheep up just south of Keswick, you know. Mm. Yes?
In your talk you mentioned the word court.
Yes.
Sheep's court.
Yes.
And Vicky's just mentioned Arncliffe. Not far away from here there's a place, Arncliffe Court. What is a court?
Oh, that's very interesting to me. Well, the best I can make of it is that you've got two things here. They call them Burcarie, which it's, I suppose it's really from the French, berger. I can only say that in our Cistercian village we had civil coat and rabbi coat, and they were the coats on either side of the salt marshes. So in other words, I've always assumed, and in fact there were great big barns left at rabbi coat, I've always assumed that those were the really big shelters for sheep when they were driven off, in our case, off the salt marsh. So I would guess that there had to be coats because of the hard weather. I mean, I take it, I don't know what sort of snow you've had over the last two or three years here, but there'd be times when you couldn't put sheep out to graze, I assume. And you've got to have refuges for your sheep. And there is money paid for hay, by the way, to show that they're feeding hay to someone. Is that any answer?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, there's an area near Lytham which is called Salt Coats.
Salt Coats, yes.
And obviously the salt marsh covered a much greater area of the south of the Fylde in medieval times before all the barriers were put up.
Yes.
So that would be the same thing, wouldn't it?
I assume so. Yes, certainly on the Solway, the whole of that plain next to the Solway Firth itself is grazing. And we still have in my village called Abbeytown
a home culture. We did have, in my time, we had a herd, and he was called the Marsh Herd. And his full-time job was to look after the cattle that were stinted onto these salt marshes.
I'm a bit worried about these marauding Scots.
Quite right.
You feel
guilty. The prior have some sort of responsibility to defend these tenants and the raising army? Or?
You see, the thing is that the canonical orders, like the Cistercians, were not fighting men. They weren't trained to be that. They could hire men sometimes.
Yeah,
I suspect when he went to Rome, he probably had one or two, you know, squires with him. But that was the whole point. They were sustaining the order against the demons by their prayers, you see, and the chaps who were doing the fighting were actually, many of them, in dire sin, because to kill somebody was still considered very sinful. And therefore, you had to do penance for it. You would certainly be sent to purgatory if you had killed somebody. So the knights knew that. I expect if you were a crusader, you were forgiven.
Yes, that was a good comment.
Adrian stopped them, really. Put that wall up.
Did the canons and so on, did they organise good works for the local populace? Like the other monks did.
Well, we'd like to think so, but there's very little evidence in the accounts of that. Just occasionally, there is mention of the prior giving food. It's small quantities, or occasionally giving money, probably halfpennies, you know, to people. But when he does give alms, it often turns out to be to local knights.
There was a kind of gruel, because I looked into this. I was trying to prove that they were a bit more charitable than John and the others were saying. And there was a kind of amount of the barley and the, particularly the oats that
yes,
went together with the beans, I think it was,
yes,
as well,
right.
That they made some sort of porridge stuff that they did give, but it wasn't, you know, out of the big pie of the expenditure, it was extremely
I think you could hope that some of those leftovers, which there must have been, to the poor who would queue up at the door of the priory in turn.
I suppose they gave a lot of employment, didn't they?
Yes, and of course, although they were, you know, they were the masters and we were the peasants, on the other hand, if we worked for them, we had guaranteed food for a year. And that, you know, that really was a very important benefit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very.
When you said that the wool went to Florence, and I was expecting you to say Flanders.
Well, actually,
so when did Flanders?
I was wrong. Some of it went to Florence, but of course, the Italians, being bankers, managed the wool import into Flanders as well as back into Italy. Yes,
traders.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they were the wholesale merchants. Really? Yeah. Sorry. Thanks for that correction.
Thank you. No, it wasn't. It was unexpected when you said Florence.
Yes.
I mean, later on, it was when around about the time of Richard Moon, it was all going for the Flemish weavers, wasn't it?
Yes, and in fact, the Flemish retained their ascendancy in the cloth trade for certain special fabrics right on. But on the other hand, because of the tremendous unrest in the towns of Flanders during the 14th century, there were rebellions and all kinds of things. Mm. And of course, they suffered from the same kind of catastrophe that happened here. The trade went back into England, and we started producing the actual cloth.
Okay. Is there any record of them being involved in mining and the lead?
Yes, yes. Just a bit of lead. I don't think they're like the Cistercians where, you know, for example, my own abbey, within about 40 years of it being founded, it was opening up an iron mine in West Cumberland. With a grant from the Countess of Oldenau. But there's nothing like that in here. But they do get local iron, and they do get local lead. Yes, yes. They buy it in. I don't say they might have done some work, but you see, they haven't got a big workforce like the Cistercians, you know, with perhaps 50 or 100, what are called conversi, i.e. monks who don't have to do the choir services seven times a day.
We've heard what John de Lorme did as far as managing the estate was concerned. What would the other members of the priory do?
Well, you can imagine what it was like. I mean, if he was riding round to all the different Augustinian houses, for example, or he was riding down to Rome and back, there must have been a team, mustn't there? You can imagine. And they sent people, to Boston every year, you see, and there'd probably be two or three, probably with mounted armed men or bowmen. Most of us were bowmen, by the way, in those days. Quite good bowmen, too. They'd go to Boston with him. But also, they had to go to Scarborough. Guess what they got there? Dried fish sent over from Bergen. When we went to Bergen, Jen and I found that there were actual records of them exporting fish to the Yorkshire coast around 1300, yes. And they spent immense quantities, because of course, if you did the right thing in the priory, you had fish at least twice a week, and sometimes three times.
And Lent, of course.
And Lent, you had to. Yeah.
How long would it have taken them to get to Rome
in the pilgrimage? I actually have somewhere in my papers the actual dates. I think, speaking from memory, I think about 57 days riding. You can work it out because it's about 25 miles a day, but the channel crossing has to be added on this thing. Mm. It's it's a big job, isn't it? You know,
and those days,
and just imagine, you'd be saddle sore, wouldn't you?
But as they went along, would they join up with others on the road?
Oh, yes.
So they would then be guided and protected by.
And they'd go to Augustinian houses, or they'd go to Cistercian houses, or Benedictine houses, who would look after them and refresh them and. And treat them as important visitors.
Limited the amount of time that they could travel in a day because they have to rest the horses if they were going to be travelling for 50 odd days.
You're right, you can't actually ride the same horse 25 miles a day for 50 odd days, can you? You'd have to take more than one. They did have a stud of horses.
What sort of boats would they cross the channel in?
I think not unlike the ones that William the Conqueror brought his army across on, you see in the Bayeux Tapestry. They just had to be able to take horses and on a plank. On a plank deck.
Did they actually go over the Alps, or did they go?
Yes, they. Well, the Mont-Cenis was one of the favourite passes to go through, and then you headed down for Lucca. There was a famous portrait of Christ there, which it said had spoken to some poor peasants. So you went to that. Then you went down through Viterbo, where the papal chancery was, and then finally to Rome. And as you got to Rome, there was a great triumphal march, and it had a mosaic of Jesus in green and gold, and I think there's another colour, you know, a splendid kind of greeting.
You'd have to speak more than one language, really.
That's the interesting thing. I mean, first of all, they spoke Latin, which was a common language among all the monks, you see. So in the church, you're all right. And then they spoke French, if they were... I mean, they were local lads, but they were probably coming from free families in the village, local villages. And then, of course, they speak our kind of English. I mean, a Yorkshire dialect.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for. See, the ladies are peeking through the door of the teacher on this. It reminds me to thank you, John, for that most interesting insight into religious life and medieval life and the horrors of climate change. Okay, thank you very much.